Hello, this is Science Weekly Extra. I'm Alok Jha. This is the full interview with Paul Davis, astrophysicist at Arizona State University and the chair of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence's Post-Detection Task Group. He's the man who'll probably make first contact with aliens. The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, was also on hand in the studio to ask some questions. I began by asking Paul Davis how common life was in the universe.
Well, of course, we don't know. That's the big question we'd like to answer. At the moment, we have only one sample of life, and it's here on Earth. For all we know, that's all there is. But the hope of the subject, astrobiology, is that life is widespread in the universe. We can't estimate how likely it is because we don't have a theory of life's origin. We just have a collection of speculations. So you can't put a number to it unless you have a proper theory to explain how life came to exist in the first place.
That doesn't stop scientists from trying to work out, perhaps. There's the famous Drake equation, of course, which tries to estimate based upon various conditions that are on planets and the number of planets that might exist, about the numbers of or the probabilities of life existing elsewhere. I mean, if not, how common is life then in the universe? How likely is it that there's life in the rest of the universe?
I think we have to make a big distinction between life and intelligent life. The Drake equation refers to the number of communicating civilizations that there might be in the Milky Way. And so the first step on the road to a communicating civilization is the transition from non-life to life. We don't have a theory of that. Nobody knows how life began. So we don't know whether it's something that is very likely to happen or very unlikely to happen. And so the first thing we need to do is to get a better handle on that big unknown, because all of the other factors in the so-called Drake equation are less uncertain than that one. So that's the one that really interests me. How did life begin? It interested Darwin, but he thought that it was pointless to speculate. He said it's mere rubbish to talk about how life began. One might as well talk about the origin of matter, was the way he expressed it rather nicely. Well, 150 years on, we can now explain the origin of matter. So that's one thing that physicists have achieved. But the origin of life is a much tougher nut to crack. And so at this particular time, there are theories and speculations, but no consensus on what it took to turn non-life into life, what initially sparked the first living thing.
Robin?
The one way that we can be sure that we have found life on another world, at least one outside our solar system, is to hear from them. I mean, that's why the search for an extraterrestrial intelligence is so important. Recently, Frank Drake suggested that in our galaxy of approximately 100 billion stars, there may be as many as 10,000 communicating civilizations. Do you feel that's an optimistic, pessimistic kind of figure?
I think the appropriate comment on that is that it's a meaningless figure, for the simple reason that it's a matter of make up the number you first thought of and double it, because Frank doesn't know any more than anybody else the probability that life will form on an Earth-like planet. We can estimate the number of Earth-like planets as probably about a trillion in the Milky Way. But how many among those trillion planets actually have life on them? It could be one, could be Earth only, or it could be the entire trillion. Nobody has a clue as to what the answer is. And so using the Drake equation to go on to estimate the number of communicating civilizations is just leaping ahead of ourselves, because until we can nail down that first step, the probability of life's origin on an Earth-like planet, then the rest of it is moot. So coming up with that number, the way Frank gets that number is he assumes that if you have an Earth-like planet, life is inevitable. It's bound to occur. In other words, it's something that is going to be like clockwork, like crystallization. It's something that, that just given the conditions, you can be absolutely sure you'll get the crystal at the end, as if life is a state of matter which is predetermined by the physical conditions. Now, it may be that that's the case, but we absolutely don't know that. It's completely wide open, which is why it's so important to do the experiment, why we need to do SETI to see if we pick up signals from an advanced civilization. But even more to the point, we need to investigate that first step, the transition from non-life to life. And most of the astrobiology program, which is now huge around the world, is focusing on that first step. SETI is the other end of the spectrum.
Paul, your book, The Eerie Silence, is actually dedicated to Frank Drake. We've talked about him a little bit now. Let's discuss him a little bit. He set up the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence 50 years ago now, and it's a network of places which look for radio signals from possibly advanced civilizations elsewhere. We had Seth Shostak, one of the senior astronomers from SETI, in the podcast a little while ago. But just take us through how SETI works now and what Frank Drake's vision was for it.
In the 1950s, when the first large radio telescopes were being built, astronomers came to realize that they had the power and the sensitivity to transmit messages across interstellar distances. So that it was suggested that by turning one of these big radio dishes on candidate stars, likely stars where there might be some transmitting civilization, we might pick up their radio traffic and, who knows, maybe even a message directed at Earth from some advanced civilization. And so the SETI project began in 1960 with Frank Drake using the Green Bank radio telescope in West Virginia to listen in to a few nearby stars. Well, of course, he didn't hear anything, but the SETI project expanded and now is a global project. In total, it probably doesn't involve more than a dozen or so radio astronomers, but nevertheless, they're very active, and they use the world's largest radio telescope, the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico, from time to time. Of course, it's used for many other things, too. They now have a dedicated system in California that's being built that will greatly increase the power of this search. So this is an ongoing effort, but 50 years after Drake's pioneering work, we still haven't picked up anything. We haven't picked up a message directed at mankind, nor have we picked up anyone else's radio traffic. We haven't stumbled across, inadvertently, across messages flitting from one civilization to another. So the sky seems to be radio quiet, at least in our vicinity. Of course, they've only looked in a tiny patch of the galaxy so far.
So there's two options now. One is you look in larger parts of the galaxy or other frequencies, but also in your book you talk about some more radical ways of perhaps extending the search. Now you're talking about signaling with neutrinos or maybe sending out smart probes. Take us through some of those.
Right. So the first thing to say is that good luck to Frank and his colleagues. I hope they carry on and they should continue what they're doing. But I think after 50 years of an eerie silence, it's time to take stock and say, well, maybe we're looking for the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. Maybe we should broaden the search and give up the idea that there are messages deliberately being sent our way, because ET doesn't know we're here. I think this is a really important point to get across, that when Drake and Carl Sagan and others began this work in the 60s and then developed it in the 70s, I think they very much had in mind that there might be some transmitting community maybe 100 light years away, something like that. I think that's optimistic. And even if we take Frank's estimate of 10,000 civilizations in the galaxy, that will put the nearest civilization quite likely to be, 1,000 light years away or more. And so if you're 1,000 light years away from Earth, you see Earth as it was 1,000 years ago. You don't see it as it is now.
The Battle of Hastings is just sort of happening.
Right. You see, there's no particular reason that they should be transmitting messages to Earth at that particular time. They would surely wait for our first radio signals to reach them before broadcasting something to us. So I think the idea of picking up a deliberate message is really a non-starter for a few thousand years. But we could look for beacons, for example. I think that's a better way to go. An advanced civilization might have a beacon, a bit like a lighthouse, that would sweep the plane of the galaxy with radio, not messages so much as a bleep, something that would just attract attention. But the SETI project's not well set up to look for such things because they're transient, you see. If somebody said, well, they heard a bleep in their radio telescope, fine, well, what do we do next? How do we confirm that? You have to keep a radio telescope directed at the same point of the sky, maybe for years, before it goes bleep again. Just think of a lighthouse, but think on a long timescale. But nevertheless, we could think about doing that. But we could also look for what I call general signatures of intelligence, which is to say that to answer the question, are we alone in the universe, we don't have to get a message from ET. We just merely have to deduce that there is or was some sort of intelligent civilization out there in the galaxy. And so we can look for signs of intelligent activity. And the way I like to express it is that we look for anything that is fishy, anything that looks like it doesn't have a natural explanation. And I like to draw the analogy with a crime scene. Forensic scientists come along, there's a dead body. Did the person die of natural causes or was there foul play? They may have to look very carefully. There may be only very subtle clues that a crime was perpetrated. So we're looking for subtle clues, not that there's a crime out there in the galaxy, but that some particular process or phenomenon might not have a completely natural origin. And these may be very subtle signs.
This will be difficult given that we might not recognize the signatures of ET.
Right.
I mean, for example, if you were to fire a laser at someone 300 years ago, they might not know what it is.
Right, right.
So they might think it's a natural phenomenon anyway.
Yeah. So in the original conception of SETI, the assumption was that that we're the new kids on the block, and therefore ET, being so much farther ahead, would naturally signal us using primitive technology appropriate to our level of development. But if we're not talking about deliberate messages now, we're just talking about what a very advanced civilization might do and what sort of technological footprint it might make, then we do have our work cut out to guess what it might be. It may involve physical principles that we don't even understand yet. It may involve types of particles or waves we haven't yet discovered. But in science, you do what you can do. That is, you take the best of your scientific understanding at the time, and you work with that. What else can we do? We can't make up fairy stories about future science, because the chances are we'll be wrong. So I think we have to work within our existing scientific framework, but even that encompasses a lot of things. So, for example, if we imagine the concept of the beacon is one where you don't have a particular recipient in mind, you just sort of put the news out there or the message out there. It's a calling card, really. There are many other ways that an advanced civilization could send us a calling card. For example, they may package the information in some sort of robot. It could be a spacecraft of a conventional sort, something about the size of a satellite, but I think much more likely would be some sort of nano probes. Because you can make them in their countless trillions and spread them around the galaxy. And these nanoprobes should ideally be self-repairing and self-replicating, so that if there's a message or something to attract our attention, that it should be able to propagate and survive for hundreds of millions of years. You have to think on that sort of timescale in this game. Unfortunately, we know that such things already exist, that living cells are precisely repositories of information, then little nanomachines. Viruses are even smaller. They can encapsulate quite a lot of information. We can imagine viruses being sent out and then injecting their message into the genomes of any organisms they may encounter.
So the first signs of ET we might get are some sort of plague or virus coming along to sort of instill knowledge from another world into
It wouldn't be knowledge. No, I think, first of all, again, we have to think on immense timescales. It could be that, say, 2 billion years ago, some viruses entered the solar system and inserted some of their RNA or DNA into living cells. At that time, they were only just microbes, and that this information has been carried along inside the genomes of these microbes ever since. Well, we're sequencing microbes anyway, so why don't we just look and see if there's anything fishy in these genomes, in the microbes all around us. Now, obviously, it's a very fanciful hypothesis, but I think it's perhaps no more fanciful than that there are radio messages coming our way.
A fanciful hypothesis that you should definitely option as a film immediately. Be careful. Well, no one steals that idea.
I should just say that I agree with Freeman Dyson on this sort of thing, that in science, you do what you can do, even if it is wildly implausible. And the point is that you can, because genomes are being sequenced anyway, costs you nothing to run a computer algorithm to just look for peculiar combinations of letters in the genetic alphabet. We might as well do that. The chances of success are, of course, exceedingly small. But why don't we just do it? Why don't we just check?
Well, let's talk a bit about the sort of beyond science stuff now. In science fiction, the story is always filled with aliens that can travel faster than light and mine energy from black holes and all of this. Stuff that for our sort of human engineering capabilities is impossible right now. It's not to say that physically these things might not be solved. I mean, what's the likelihood that these sort of science fiction staples will be true in alien civilizations? Or are there lines which even they could never cross?
Right. The laws of physics can't be broken by anybody. It's not a question of technology. And this is a really important distinction, and one that a lot of people don't make, the distinction between what might be physically impossible, because it breaks the laws of nature, and what might be technologically very hard. So you mentioned traveling faster than light. We believe that that is a fundamental law of the universe, and that however much money that you have, however developed your technology might be, there's nothing you can do about that. On the other hand, mining energy from black holes is a physically possible thing. It's a process I've actually studied in my own research. That is something that could be done. We can't do it, but it's not because it's violating any law. It's simply we haven't got enough money. We don't have access to a black hole. But given a super civilization with enormous resources, they could mine energy from a black hole.
And this is the kind of thing where you would build essentially a shell around this black hole to get the energy out. I mean, is that people have come up with conceptions for these?
Oh, absolutely.
Things.
So this is not just drawings
and ideas.
This is an interesting idea. It all goes back to Roger Penrose at Oxford University, who in the late 1960s recognized that a rotating black hole can give up its energy if you send in a particle on a carefully defined trajectory, would break into two, and one of these particles would go down the black hole and the other one would come out with more energy than the original particle had that went in. And you extract the energy at the expense of the rotation of the black hole, so it spins down. Eventually it stops spinning and you can't get any more energy out. And so this was much studied in the 70s, and it is directly related to Stephen Hawking's discovery that black holes are not black, but actually radiate heat and eventually evaporate away, so they give off their energy like that. But extracting energy from a rotating black hole is something that we all believe is absolutely spot on. It complies with Einstein's general theory of relativity. And John Wheeler, the American physicist who coined the term black hole, came up with this fanciful scenario of building a shell around the rotating black hole, and the inhabitants of the community on that shell would dispose of their rubbish. This is the perfect solution to the energy crisis. You dump your garbage into the black hole and it pays you with energy. So you run your industry from the recycling of absolute and complete disposal of the garbage. It leaves the entire universe.
And you'd have the access to the amounts of energy you'd need to travel to other civilizations with this sort of power. Robin.
Yeah, I just raised that point about travelling from one civilization to another. If the speed of the light is an absolute limit dictated by Einstein, and we accept that, you can't travel faster than light. You can probably only travel a fraction of it, say a tenth of the speed of light, if you really put a lot of energy and built a huge big spaceship. That suggests 100 years journey to get to more or less the nearest likely slightly optimistic looking star. Really, nobody's going to do that, and nobody's going to do it to us. It strongly suggests that, you know, interstellar travel is just not on for them or us.
I think a lot of people have come to that conclusion. And after all, if we're right in the idea that the galaxy is teeming with intelligent life, rather undermines the motivation for making the journey, because why expend all that money and resource and time going to some star, you know, 100 light years away, when the people who live there the beings who live there can just send us their video, their travelogue, and we get all the information we want. So you have to think, you know, what is the purpose of this travel? Is it tourism? Is it research? Well, both of those I guess tourism will always be there, but for the research, there's no point. Colonization. So if we look at the pattern of expansion on Earth, people have spread out around the Earth in order to colonize it. But I think it makes very little sense for human beings to go off try to colonize the galaxy if it's already occupied by a large number of other species. Now, of course, there is a different scenario, which is that there are just a very few advanced civilizations that have got through their technological bottleneck and have survived, and that they may have spread out in the galaxy. We don't see them here on Earth, so this is the famous Fermi paradox. Enrico Fermi said, I think around about 1950, where are they? He realized that if there were any spacefaring, colonizing, expanding civilizations in the galaxy, that there's plenty of time for them to have come here, because although, as you pointed out, it takes a long time to go from one star to another, in astronomical terms, it's not very long. The galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. So at a tenth of the speed of light, you could cross it in a million years. Well, the galaxy is 13 billion years old. So plenty of time for a civilization that maybe started, say, 2 or 3 billion years ago to have completely spread across the whole galaxy and to have colonized a lot. Well, we don't see them here on Earth. So some people have run computer models of rather more sophisticated versions of how colonization might work. And of course, the idea that you just uniformly spread out in every direction is a bit naive. It'd be much more likely to be a sort of patchwork quilt, I think, of activity. And there may be a patchwork. It may be that when we look out at the galaxy, we see what appear to just be uninhabited spaces and stars. We see no evidence for any tech, large-scale technology at work. But maybe if we look more carefully, we'll see that there is a patchwork quilt of colonization.
Why is the interest in this stuff from, if I may, more serious ends of scientific research got better, more intense in the last few years? I mean, the recent Royal Society meeting, there was 2 days at the oldest scientific academy in the world on something which some might argue is a bit of a pipe dream.
Right. So it mystifies me as well, because I've been interested in this subject since I was a student. And back in the 60s, if you expressed an interest in extraterrestrial intelligence, well, you might have as well expressed an interest in fairies. It really was considered a very, very fringe activity. A lot of people thought it was just science fiction or pseudoscience, wasn't a respectable thing to do. I think it's extraordinary that Frank Drake was prepared to go ahead and to patiently carry out this, begin this SETI project. Extraordinary courage. But over the years, it has, as you pointed out, become more and more accepted. Until now, it is pretty much part of mainstream astrobiological research. I think everybody feels it's worth doing. Now, what are the reasons for that? Well, one reason is because it's almost entirely privately funded. So it's not a drain on the public purse. So the cynics that might otherwise say, well, why are we wasting all this money on such an absurd enterprise, are silenced because it's private money that's doing it. People often say that we have a better understanding now of extrasolar planets, of the conditions under which life might flourish and so on, and all this leads us to feel that it's more likely that there's life out there. But that's simply not true. As I said earlier, we have no idea what the probability is that life will emerge on an Earth-like planet. We're beginning to discover planets that I think very soon we will find other Earths. But I think most astronomers already suspected that they were there 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So I think the change in mood is largely a change in fashion. It's a sociological phenomenon. It's not a scientific. It's not that we've made some amazing scientific discoveries and now we know that this is a worthwhile quest. I think we're just as ignorant about the basic phenomena involved that we were 20 or 30 years ago. So it's a change in fashion.
Is it also a maturity of the fact that the space age is essentially is barely a half a century old? It might take hundreds more years of advances and technological achievements on our own part before we start understanding really what's out there To the, I mean, even the last 10 years, the number of extrasolar planets we've discovered has gone up exponentially.
Right.
We knew none of them in the early 90s, and now there's
hundreds.
No,
but we sort of suspected they were there. Yeah. You see, that's the point I'm making. And the fact that we've now confirmed that they're there, really, has that caused such a fundamental shift, such a major change in attitude to this whole subject? Maybe that's all it took. I don't know. As I say, I'm mystified along with you.
Of course, that leads to the question, what happens if we do make contact and we do hear from ET and we do realise that there are some, at least one very advanced extraterrestrial civilization out there? What do you think will be the social impact or the political or the religious? I mean, what will it do to society?
Well, I think the discovery that we're not alone in the universe would have to rank as the biggest scientific discovery of all time. It would dwarf the discoveries of Copernicus and Galileo and Darwin and Einstein. It would easily be the most significant thing. But when contemplating the consequences of this discovery, I think it's important to make a distinction between the traditional SETI hope, which is we receive a message from some civilization saying, hello, humans, you know, have we got news for you? which I think if that happened, all bets would be off. It would be transformative and disruptive beyond the point that anybody could predict. But I think what is much more likely is what I was talking about earlier, that we will discover an unambiguous signature of intelligence. We'll be able to say, well, there's a star over there, 2,000 light years away, that we are now convinced, having assembled all the evidence, has it or a planet going around it or something in its vicinity cannot be explained by natural means. There must be some alien technology at work. That's all we can say. And then I think it would be a discovery that would rank very much like Copernicus showing that the Earth goes around the sun, that it didn't cause any riots. As far as I know, nobody committed suicide with this knowledge. Didn't affect the price of beer. Everything carried on much the same as before. But some hundreds of years later, of course, it's fundamentally changed the way we think about ourselves and our place in the universe. That, and if we think of Darwin's theory of evolution, once again, caused a certain amount of stir, discussion in the chattering classes and so on, some disruption to religion, but it really didn't. There were no revolutions, no riots when Darwin's book was published. But who would deny that today it forms a really important backdrop of our thinking, the fact that we know that we have emerged from the natural world, that we have a common lineage with our fellow animals on this planet and so on. These things are really important to know. So they change our worldview in a fundamental way. So I think the discovery that we are not alone in the universe would, over some decades, maybe some centuries, dramatically transform the way we think about ourselves. But it's not going to cause any rioting, and the governments aren't going to be hushing it up or anything of that sort.
Or the church's fall.
Right. Now, I think there is a real issue for religion. I've long thought that. All the world's great religions were formulated in a pre-scientific era, and they all place human beings in a very important role, even a central role. The fact that humans would be seen as just one intelligent species among countless others in the universe, because if we discover one other intelligent civilization, you can be sure there's going to be a very large number of them. The fact that there is this bigger community, no existing religion could survive. They all say that it's not a problem, but I'm absolutely convinced they'll all be swept away. Now, that isn't to say that there would be no place for something like religion or spirituality, that there may well be, you know, some grander version that would replace it, but the traditional religions would clearly be swept away. There's no doubt in my mind, whatever the ministers of those religions might say. Christianity is especially vulnerable to the discovery of advanced alien intelligences. The other religions are not so bad, but Christianity is, because of the unique nature of the incarnation. So Christians believe that Jesus Christ is the God incarnate and came to earth to save mankind, Homo sapiens, one species. So Jesus didn't come and die to save the dolphins or the chimpanzees or the gorillas or the Neanderthals or the other species of Homo that died out, but to save one particular species with one particular genome. And so it's very, very specific. It's a species-specific religion. Now, if you've got advanced alien beings who presumably have been around for a lot longer than we have, and if they've survived the sort of problems that we're facing here on Earth, then they'll have solved a great deal of their social unrest and a great deal of their criminality. And probably, I think it's inevitable, that if we're talking about biological organisms, would have engineered their genomes to remove grossly criminal behavior. I'm sure this is what humans are going to do within a couple of centuries, that we will simply not tolerate genocide or mass murder or anything like that. That people who are defective in that way that will be eliminated from the gene pool. So I'm sure that we will engineer post-humans who will whose standards, moral standards and ethical standards were much higher than ours now. I'm convinced this is going to happen further down the track. So, well, but E.T. will already be there. They will be saintly beings. And so then we face the problem. If you're a Christian, are they not to be saved? Why is it only humans that get
saved? Or in other words, they've achieved saintliness without the hand of God.
Well, okay.
Or a different God.
Or now, a different God, yes, sorry.
Now, this particular issue has been debated for several centuries. It's only in the last 50 years or so it's gone quiet. So Christians knew that they were in a bind on this. And so some of them thought, well, there must be multiple incarnations. And others thought, no, it's got to be a unique incarnation. And somehow the Word, which is really the foundation of the Christian religion, the notion of the Word, that this Word would be communicated to the universe from Earth. There have been distinguished theologians and even scientists prepared to argue for both of these. But you can see the problem that the Christians are in, that what do you do about the incarnation? That Jesus was supposed to be God's only begotten Son. It's there in the Bible. So you can throw that out if you like, if you're not a Christian. I'm not a Christian, so it doesn't bother me. I'm not a religious person in any conventional sense. But I take these issues very seriously because I think the discovering life in the universe and discovering intelligent life is a spiritual quest as well as a scientific quest, because it helps inform human beings who they are and how they fit into the universe. I think that the clatter of world religions as we see them now would be swept away by this discovery. So what I'm saying here is very polemical, very dramatic sounding, but I think a lot of people don't face up to that fact, that the existing world religions have to change, whether we discover E.T. or not, because they really are fixed in the past, in a pre-scientific era, and we now live in a scientific age.
That was Paul Davis from the Arizona State University. His new book, Eerie Silence, is out now. If you want to go to one of his lectures, check out penguin.co.uk/eeriesilence. Next week, we'll be having a right chuckle with Professor Richard Wiseman, who'll be looking into the science of laughter. Don't forget to add your voice to our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast extra was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.